So we are in Colossians chapter 3 this morning, and I was trying to think of how to start this off this morning. I usually try to intro our message in some way, and I was sitting with Abby. We were talking about, she's shaking her head, we were talking about words that have changed meaning over the years and are no longer, don't always mean what they used to mean, right? You probably have experienced this before, especially if you're older. In generations, when younger generations use a certain word, to you, it brings up other ideas, right? I mean, you just remember the way you used to use it as a kid is not the way that it's used now. When I was growing up, wicked was like something you would use for cool. Man, that's wicked. Anybody use that? If you're my age, 30s? Anybody? Okay, so thank you, Starla. Appreciate that. Everybody else is looking at me like, what in the world? And, of course, sometimes this is geographic differences, too. In Ohio, you might not have used wicked. But in Maryland, we use wicked. Kids today, if I use that word, they'd be like, what are you talking about? And many of the older folks in this room did the same thing to me because you didn't use that word that way. When you thought of wicked, you thought of something that's evil, right? Words change meaning over time. And we're going to encounter a word this morning. You probably already picked up on it in our passage in Colossians 3. That over time has come to mean different things for different people. And part of the reason we have such a difficult time with this passage is really because the ideas and the connotations that come to mind when this passage is read and the different ways that we interpret it. And so this morning I'll come back to that thought, but I wanted to start with that because it's important that we understand where Paul's coming from, and that's what we're going to explore this morning. But what Paul is doing in this passage that was just read is he's continuing a conversation in Colossians 3 that he's already started. He already talked about in the beginning of the passage, if then, last week we looked at, if you have been raised with Christ, then set your mind on things above, right? And then he goes through about three different movements in that section of, if you are in Christ, here's how your life should be different. These are the things that you should be putting away. Sexual morality, anger, slander, all these kinds of things, these sins that happen with our tongue, with our sexual decisions. And then put on, and it goes through the list, patience, kindness, humility, gentleness, all these different things that, as a Christian, this is how my life should look now. This is what my life should be characterized by. And it's tempting to think of this next section as a separate one from what he's just talked about, except that it's not. What Paul is doing now is he's getting down into, okay, so now that we've talked about the theory of how this works, if you've been raised with Christ, this is what your life should be like. Here's how it looks in relationship. Remember, we talked about last week that all of the sins that Paul mentions are relational sins. When I speak against you, when I use my tongue in an improper way, when I choose sexually something that shouldn't be chosen, all of these things impact other people. And all the things that Paul says our life should be characterized by as a Christian now are relational in nature. I should have love for you. I should be humble. I should be patient with you and forgive you. And just the same way, he's going to dig down into, okay, let's talk about specific relationships. And so for the next several weeks, not counting Easter Sunday, we'll do something next week different. But for the next several lessons in this section, we're going to talk about different relationships in our lives that are impacted by our relationship with Christ and what those should look like. And the first of these is the marriage relationship. And I'd encourage you this morning as we go through this, even if you're not married, think about if you were to be married, or if you're maybe dating somebody right now, or if you've dated somebody in the past and hope to date someone in the future, what might my life look like as a person in a relationship with someone else? So Paul talks about husbands and wives. He'll talk about children and fathers. He'll talk about slaves and masters, which is an interesting conversation. But all of this has to do with what does my life look like under Christ? And the first one is this issue of love and respect. And what he says to the women first, the wives, is what ultimately kind of makes a lot of folks bristle, at least in today's culture, right? Wives, submit to your husbands. And I probably didn't have to read any further than already things are starting to come to mind for you, right? Guys, your idea of what submission looks like comes to mind. Women, if it's been misused in your life, maybe some bitterness or something of that kind, or maybe it's not a problem for you. But this is where the culture kind of stops us for a moment, because we've gotten this idea of submission that is totally different than what Paul is really talking about here. In 21st century America, this is a difficult one, because even that statement labels me as I speak it in some way. If somebody, especially from outside, were listening to this, they might label me as chauvinistic or oppressive or manipulative or something like that. This is not what Paul is intending to get across with this message. And part of it, I think, comes from where we've been in years past in our culture and the idea of submission for past generations. So I want to share something with you that I have heard before, and maybe you've heard this before as well. And I tried to find the origin of the article, and I can't confirm that it actually existed in a magazine, but the story is that it was printed, this article that I'm going to read to you, was printed in the May 13th edition, 1955, of Housekeeping Monthly. Okay? And so you think about 1950s culture, right? Think about Leave It to Beaver. Okay? Get that in your head. And this article titled How to Be a Good Housewife is printed in this magazine. And this is instructions for a woman who is a stay-at-home mom, how to be a good housewife. I want to read it to you, okay? Feel free to laugh appropriately, all right? Have dinner. Number one, these are kind of listed in order, right? Have dinner ready. Plan ahead. Even the night before, to have a delicious meal ready on time for his return. This is a way of letting him know that you've been thinking about him and are concerned about his needs. Some of you ladies are laughing. Why? The guys are like, man, that'd be really great. Most men are hungry when they get home, and the prospect of a good meal is part of the warm welcome needed. Next, prepare yourself. Take 15 minutes to rest so you'll be refreshed when he arrives. Touch up your makeup, put a ribbon in your hair, and be fresh looking. He has just been with a lot of work-weary people. Next, be a little gay and be a little more interesting for him. His boring day may need a lift, and one of your duties is to provide it. Next, clear away the clutter. Make one last trip through the main part of the house just before your husband arrives. Run a dust cloth over the tables. During the... Yeah, you're like, dust cloth, what's that? I don't know what those are. We don't have them in our house, right? Next, during the cooler months of the year, you should prepare and light a fire for him to unwind by. Your husband will feel he has reached a haven of rest and order, and it will give you a lift too. After all, catering to his comfort will provide you with immense personal satisfaction. Minimize all noise. At the time of his arrival, eliminate all noise from the washer, dryer, or vacuum. Encourage... Yes, right? Encourage the children to be quiet. Impossible, right? Be happy to see him. Greet him with a warm smile and show sincerity in your desire to please him. Listen to him. You may have a dozen important things to tell him, but the moment of his arrival is not the time. Let him talk first. Remember, his topics of conversation are more important than yours. Don't greet him with complaints and problems. Don't complain if he's late for dinner or even if he stays out all night. Count this as minor. Yeah, that's right. Don't say anything, yeah. Count this as minor compared to what he might have gone through at work. Make him comfortable. Have him lean back in a comfortable chair or lie him down in the bedroom. Have a cool or warm drink ready for him. Arrange a pillow and offer to take off his shoes. Speak, this is really fun. Speak in a low, soothing, and pleasant voice. Don't ask him questions about his actions or question his judgment or integrity. Remember, he is the master of the house and as such will always exercise his will with fairness and truthfulness. You have no right to question him. Okay. So, whether or not that actually appeared in a magazine somewhere, I could not confirm that. However, when I think in my head and I wasn't there, so all of you who were in 1950s America, you know, feel free to discard this if it wasn't true. But when I watched shows like Leave It to Beaver, right? I watched Leave It to Beaver growing up, and I just remember Mrs. Cleaver, when Ward would come home from work, Wally and Beav would all be nice and, you know, tidy, and they'd have to, "Hi, Father," you know, the greeting at the door, and things were a certain way for him. He would read his paper, sit down in his easy chair while dinner was getting ready, or dinner would be on the table when he got home. And those of you who lived through those times know that generally, maybe not this blatant, but generally, this is kind of how things were in the house. There was a place and a role that a woman played, and a place and a role for a man, right? That was 70 years ago, you know? Things have changed just a little bit, you know? it's okay, I won't say it. I won't say anything. I'm trying to be really good here. There's so many things in my mind. But things have changed, right? But this, when you mention this word submit, when you mention the word submission, this is what most people think of, right? Because this is the way it was portrayed in our culture in the past. That this was how wives submit to their husbands, take care of the house, and do their duties. That's not exactly what Paul had in mind. And part of the problem with this passage is that we think of something that really wasn't on Paul's mind either, but for our culture used to be, and has since been pretty vehemently rejected by a lot of folks, as all of the things that we already talked about. So the question might be, what does submit really mean? When Paul says submit, what does he mean? I'm going to throw this out to you and see, and kind of back away from it for a minute and come back to it. Biblically, the idea of submission is less about importance and value, which is how we view it, right? You even heard it in the article. His conversation is more important than yours, you know? And it makes you feel a certain way in value, that there's a less than, greater than type of relationship here. Biblically, that's not the case. Submission is more about role and leadership than about importance and value. I'll give you an example. Paul will say, as is fitting in the Lord. This is how things are in the Lord in this passage. He talks about this in another area, in 1 Corinthians 11:3. If you want to turn over there, I'd encourage you to do it, because this kind of will help make sense of this passage a little more. In 1 Corinthians 11:3, Paul is talking about a completely different topic. He's talking about women praying and prophesying, and different issues related to that. But in verse 3, he says this, "But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of a wife is her husband, and the head of Christ is God." Head in that passage means leadership or role. It doesn't mean importance. It doesn't mean value. In other words, if it meant value, we'd have to say that Christ, because he's in submission to God, is less valuable than God. And we know that's not true either. And so it comes down to what is our function in the relationships that we have with each other. Every relationship has a different role and a different function. Even you and I, in relationship with each other, because of our personalities, we're going to play different parts in the relationship, different roles in the relationship. And so biblically, submission is placing myself under the leadership of someone and showing respect, the appropriate respect, to someone in this relationship. And at its core, this is really what it's about. Submission is really about respect, which is interesting because it hits on something that men are wired to receive. Respect. I'll get to that in a minute. Respect for leadership, for the role of man in a marriage, as the caretaker of the family. And what's interesting about what Paul will say in this passage is that each of these commands, to men as well as to women, because we'll get to the man in a minute, each of these commands to the man, to the woman, has to do with something that the other desperately needs. The man desperately desires and needs your respect, wives. We'll get to this in a minute. Guys, the woman desperately needs and respect and needs and desires your love. So Paul is really hitting on something that is at our core, the way that we're wired and needing to be accepted in a relationship. In 2004, this book came out. I don't know if has anybody read this book, Love and Respect? No? Have you heard of it? Anybody seen this on the bookshelf? Oh, okay. well, I kind of, this is my world, I live in it, so I can't assume that everybody does. In 2004, there was a book called Love and Respect, written by a guy named Emerson Eggerichs, and it has become a bestseller as far as, you know, if I'm premarital counseling or dealing with marriage issues, I have a few of these on my shelf, I'll probably recommend it. It's a great book. It's written, it's a Christian perspective. Emerson was actually a minister in a church doing a lot of marriage counseling with couples, and he kept running into this same problem. He kept on running into conversations where a man and a woman were at each other's throat, and the woman would say something like this: "He just doesn't love me." And he could never figure out, the guy was typically silent, he could never figure out what the deal was. It was, they'd go round and round and round, same results, same problems, right? Eventually, he came to understand that what the men weren't saying, but what they felt was, she just doesn't respect me. And so, he went to the Bible, to Scripture, to passages like these, where Paul talks about two men and women, both, about commands in marriage, and he came up with the book, Love and Respect, as foundation on key ingredients for a marriage coming from each partner in the marriage. And so Paul will continue with his comments to the man after he leaves the woman and the respect and the submission issue. He'll talk to the husbands and he'll say, "Husbands, love your wives." And I know this kind of sounds trite because we talk about love like it's just some thing, except when you understand where Paul's coming from and what he's really talking about. Love is really what a woman desires and needs in a relationship. Connection, belonging, security. What's fascinating about a woman is that often a woman will give sex to get these things, not because she's interested in the physical aspects of the relationship so much as she's interested in the emotional connectivity that comes from feeling loved, accepted, secure, belonging. And this is the special kind of love that God demands of husbands. Elsewhere, Paul will use this same kind of a format to talk to husbands and wives in Ephesians 5. You might remember this. And he'll tell the husbands, love your wives as, remember this? Christ, as yourself, as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Right? So Paul takes this marriage thing with husbands loving wives and he lays it right alongside of what happened at the cross with Jesus redeeming the world and sacrificing himself for the church. He says that's the kind of love that you have for each other. It's a sacrificial, self-giving love. It's not a feeling. It's not a butterfly effect in your tummy when you get that, you know, funny stuff going on with when she comes around. It's a sacrifice. It's an action that happens in a marriage. In his research and talking with couples, Emerson, in the book, comes up with this, what he calls the crazy cycle, right? And this is what he observed in marriages. That what happens when a husband and a wife fail to show love and respect to each other? A woman, without love, reacts without respect to her husband. Without respect, a husband reacts without love to his wife. And the cycle continues. And you can see how it gets crazy, right? Because each one is doing something that the other is hating and continues to perpetuate the problem in the relationship. And part of the book is dealing with how to get out of this cycle of craziness. What's funny about marriage is that everybody has their expectations about it, right? I mean, when you got married, if you're married, or if you've been married, when you got married, you probably had some sort of expectation walking in, like, this is what it's going to be like. And whether or not that actually, you know, met up with your expectation is another concept. But everybody has their ideas of what marriage is. You might be surprised to know that in the first century, love was virtually absent from an expectation of in marriage. People didn't get married in the first century in Paul's world because they loved each other. It was more a contractual agreement that happened. And mostly because the human race, childbearing. This is why some people were surprised to find out that men had other mistresses in life, and guys would talk about this. Well, we have some women for pleasure, some for childbearing. That was the expectation in marriage. The best you could hope for in first century married culture was to live a peaceful life together and not fight and beat each other's throats. In fact, you'll find this on some gravestones in that era, first century gravestones. A wife would die and a husband would have a gravestone written, and on the gravestone would say something about it was a harmonious marriage. As if that was the best thing, right? Now, couples fall in love, obviously, but that wasn't the primary concern here. And so what Paul is really doing is he's saying something that completely obliterates the concept of marriage for these folks. It would have been natural for him to lead off with his word to the wives of, okay, wives, submit to your husbands. That was normal. In secular culture, you had other people talking about what a wife's duty was to her husband and these kinds of things laid out. It wasn't uncommon for Paul to say this, but when Paul gets to the husband, love your wives. And then he compares it to Christ loving the church. Oh my goodness. What are you talking about, Paul? You mean I can't sleep around with other women? You mean I have to sacrifice myself for her? You mean I have to lay down my life for her? Give up everything for her? Yes, absolutely. And Paul adds something else to this. I don't know if you caught this. At the end of the passage, of the verse 19, he says, husbands, love your wives, and do not be harsh with them. The word there is to become embittered. Don't become embittered against them. Treat them harshly. It's easy. I don't know why, but it's easy for guys to do this. Something happens in the relationship. Maybe a loss of respect. Husband doesn't feel respected and lashes out against his wife and becomes embittered. And then it causes the crazy cycle, right? Where she responds without love and where she responds without more respect and he starts to withhold love from her and it becomes a mess. Paul is likely dealing with this little piece at the end with the problem of what happens if my wife is not showing me respect. Because undoubtedly this would happen, right? I'm doing my part, she's not doing hers. Or I'm doing my part, he's not doing his. So Paul is dealing with the reality that some guys are going to respond with love and their wives aren't going to respond with submission and respect. So what do? Paul says, don't become embittered. Don't respond harshly to them. This does not give you a right to act the way you want. Which, in their culture, that's how it was. In fact, there was a statement made by a Jewish wise man that if she doesn't respond, if your wife doesn't respond to you in submission, then you can divorce her. Those were grounds for divorce in Paul's day. Paul says, no, not here. We're not doing that. So what's the key with all this? Where do we go with this? Both commands, I think it would be accurate and fair to say, both commands come from the aspect of what is best for the other. In my role as a husband, what is best for my wife? And that's what I do. I love her, sacrificially. As a wife, what's best for my husband? I submit to him. I respect his role as a leader in our family. Both are commitments made to the other individual. And here's where it comes into play with our culture, because our culture would say that my needs are first, right? I need to get something out of this marriage. I have an expectation with this. I have rights. You know, she needs to provide for me in this way, or he needs to provide for me in this way. And this, Paul says, no, this isn't how you do it. It's not if I'm satisfied in this relationship, I'm out. It's not if you're not taking care of me, I'm gone. Ironically, our culture, whose primary concern seems to be equalizing the roles of men and women in a marriage, in society in general, which sounds all fair and good. But then when you get underneath of it, sometimes it's interesting because there's a little bit of selfishness that comes up when I'm not being cared for. I have a right to leave. When I'm not being treated well, I have a right to leave. Paul says, as a follower of Christ, you follow his example in relationships. So a wife, you submit as Christ submits to God. As a husband, you love as Christ loved the church. And it doesn't matter what the other person does or doesn't do. You do your job and fulfill your role. Now, what if I'm in a marriage, and I get this, because it happens all the time, unfortunately. In an ideal world, you'd have equal participation from both, right? Man, 100%, woman, 100%. All in. I'm doing this, I'm loving, I'm respecting, I'm submitting, right? That doesn't always happen. So what do you do when you're in a relationship and there's no return. I'm submitting, I'm respecting, or I'm loving, I'm sacrificing, and I'm not getting anything out of it. And I want to be careful with this one because I know the pain. I feel the pain because I sit there with folks who have been there and done that. I have family that have been there and done that. And I know the misery. I've seen the misery that that causes. But again, I'll come back to the statement. Who is this for? Is it for you? Or is it for them? Is it for your relationship with God? What I find interesting about what Paul says to the man in his sacrifice and his love for the wife is that he compares it to how Christ died for the church, died for the world. The same world, the same church that put him on a cross, the same world that spit in his face as he was dying, the same world that condemned him, a convicted criminal, and he still died. He still sacrificed. He did his role, regardless of if they cared. Now, there's a caveat here. I'm not suggesting, so you don't hear me wrong on this, I'm not suggesting that you stay in an abusive relationship, in an environment where you're being hurt or harmed physically, you have reason to fear for your life, okay? That's not what I'm saying. I'm talking about the everyday apathy, neglect that often comes in a marriage because somebody just doesn't care as much as I do about this. That's what I'm talking about. Paul's marriage advice is to look to the needs of the other. And what often happens, I can't make promises here, but what often happens is if I fulfill my role, eventually they'll take notice. They'll figure it out. They'll see, wow, she cares for me. I just treated her like trash. She cares for me. Or, wow, he really does love me. I just slammed the door in his face and yelled at him, and he still brought me flowers for my birthday tomorrow. These kinds of things. Paul's marriage advice is to step out of the crazy. Step out of that cycle that we so often get ourselves in where I'm the one, it's at the center of this, my needs aren't being met, and so here's how I'm going to respond. And he says, here's how you respond because of your relationship with Christ. And let that guide and drive it. Hard stuff, right? Not easy. Not something that I'm going to go home and the first argument I'm going to have is going to be on the forefront of my mind, right? And yet, God calls us to it. Because ultimately, He did that in Christ. This morning, we're going to continue next week or the following weeks with these kinds of lessons. This morning, we're going to sing a song here and we're going to be done. If you need anything, maybe a concern having to do with the lesson, or maybe today would be the day that you decide to put Christ on in baptism, we'd be happy to help you in any way. Please come as we stand and as we sing.